For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose. Okay, we're already dealing with a difficult passage in the flood. We've got another one at the beginning of this chapter. Who or what are the sons of God? As we look at that Hebrew expression, Bena Ha Elohim, the only time that it's exactly used in that way is a threefold occurrence in the book of Job. Job chapters 1, 2, and 38, where it inextricably refers to angels. The sons of God are angels. As we flip forward into our New Testament, we read both from Jude and Peter, Jude 6 and 2 Peter 2, 4, that during the days of Noah, this exact time period, there were angels, fallen angels, who had done something atrocious which warranted being locked up in what Peter calls Tartarus, the abyss, some kind of maximum security holding tank for demons. You know, biblically speaking, demons don't live in hell, they live on earth, except for these demons. Peter says that they were locked up for doing something horrible. As we look here, too, at this expression, the daughters of men, throughout the whole book, the term for man, Adam, in chapter 5, verse 1, verse 3, verse 4, it consistently refers to humans. So whatever we're seeing here, this isn't put in opposition. It's not like it's expanding upon the sons of God. This is being put in opposition. Whoever the sons of God are, they're different from the daughters of men, which are humans. So there must have been some kind of breeding that happened here. If you think that's bizarre, it's because it is. God put a stop to this. And whatever this was, God said that his spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. So because of this occult sexuality, which is really popular in pagan religion, if you study world religions, you see this quite frequently, the concept of demons consorting with people, with humans, and producing offspring. Yeah, apparently God is totally against this. As it expounds in verse 4, it says that the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. These were the heroes of old, men of renown. So the offspring of this occult sexuality had produced these Nephilim. Nephilim is the Hebrew word. Most modern translations just leave this word untranslated because they don't know what to do with it. Literalistic translation would be the fallen ones. Most likely to fall upon prey. If you read your King James Bible, it just says giants. As we flip forward into Numbers 13, there would be reason for that translation. When the spies go out into the promised land, they come back with this report. It's the only other usage of the term Nephilim in the Old Testament. We read that they come back to Moses and Aaron and the people, and they said, we saw the Nephilim there. We were like grasshoppers in their sight. They were huge, apparently some kind of huge people. As we read through our Old Testament, we also see these giant men, Goliath, deformed man. Second Chronicles says that he had six fingers on each hand, 9 foot tall, some kind of a beast of a man. And beyond that, I don't really know what to say, so we might as well just keep going. Verse 5, the Lord observed the extent of human wickedness. There was occult sexuality. There was, instead of being born in the image of God, there was some kind of an offshoot here that disgusted God, that was warped, twisted, aberrant view of humanity. He observed this, and he observed human wickedness, and he saw that everything that they thought or imagined was consistently and totally evil. My God, total depravity. To be in this time period, I mean, this is post-civilization, maybe. Of course, I'm going to ruin the story. There was a flood, so this could have set humanity back here, to be sure. At the same time, I mean, this was nature red with tooth and claw. This was bloodshed. This was evil to an extraordinary degree. And as a consequence, we read that the Lord was sorry that he had ever made humans and put them on the earth. It broke his heart. Some people look at this passage and they ask the question, so is this saying that God didn't know that this was going to happen? Well, of course not. God knows the end from the beginning. Isaiah 46, God's knowledge is perfect. Psalm 145 says his knowledge is infinite. What this is referring to here, the Hebrew word here is naham. It literally means like a sigh, a naham, a heartfelt plea, a groan. This isn't referring to intellectual knowledge. This is referring to emotional heartache. That God was seeing this. He knew it was going to happen, yet it's right there in front of him. Yes, God can be affected emotionally. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Grace. Noah was a righteous man, the only blameless person living on the earth at the time. And he walked in close fellowship with God. He's righteous. He's blameless. Yeah, in the Old Testament, we see this pretty frequently. Relatively righteous, we could say. When everyone is just in thought, word, and deed, totally evil all the time, and you got one guy there who's kind of good, by comparison, he was righteous. We read later in Genesis chapter 9, verse 21, that Noah gets off the ark, and what's he do? He promptly gets drunk and pulls a Frank the Tank right down in the garden right there. He wasn't like a perfect guy. Righteous in the sense that he walked in close fellowship with God. Or in the New Testament concept, that we're righteous because we trust God. Not that our behavior is righteous, but we're righteous because we've trusted him. We're with him. We read in verse 11, now God saw that the earth had become corrupt and was filled with violence. Corruption. Violence. God could see this. What would that be like to be able to see the whole earth all at once? I've had those experiences, I'm sure like you, where you were able to watch a movie, maybe watch the news, seeing the distended bellies of babies, children dying of starvation, seeing genocide, murder, rape, torture. I'm watching the show currently called True Detective. It basically has all of those in it. And I get to the end of an episode and I'm like, why am I doing this to myself? You know, it's just so brutal. You need to go take a shower after just seeing some of these scenes. What would it be like to see the world through omniscient eyes? To see down right into the heart of billions of people. The actions, both the aggressor and the victim. Both the person who's hurting and the person being hurt. And you see this at all time and you can't turn it off. What do you do in that kind of a situation? How do you stomach that? I mean, even just seeing into the heart of one person, the depth of their selfishness. I mean, it would just be nauseating to think about. Well, God's solution for this is judgment. That's his solution. Now, I know some skeptics I've talked to about this, they've had a real issue with judgment. They say, you know, how can a loving God judge? And yet at the same time, we'll continue to talk and they'll talk about how much they hate the evil and suffering in the world. And why isn't God doing something about that? Well, my friend, you can't have it both ways, okay? God's solution for the problem of evil and suffering is the answer of judgment. But you can't say, I don't like this and I don't like that. It's kind of like going into a house and saying, oh, this is a big, beautiful house, but it's too expensive. Your realtor takes you down the street and you're like, oh, I like the price, but it's too small. Okay, you kind of have to make a decision here. Which is it? Do we believe in a God who judges? Well, according to the Bible, God does judge. He does judge. And his judgment isn't in contradiction to his love. Far from it. His judgment is a function of his love. To put that a different way, God could not be loving if he wasn't just. Imagine, for example, if your grandmother was beaten up, killed, and the judge found the whole gang of thugs that killed your mother, and they admitted their guilt. And the judge looked at them lovingly and said, well, you look pretty sorry. 20 hours of community service. Case closed. Bangs his gavel. Imagine the horror you would feel at that. The injustice. I mean, how could you ever respect a judge like that? You couldn't respect a judge like that. How could you ever come into his presence? You think you'd want to be friends with a judge like that? Think about it like this. Imagine if you lived in a country where the government never enforced any laws. What's the difference between that and a country where there are no laws? Well, we live in a moral universe. Good and evil are real. And God is is morally violated by evil. He takes a stand against that. And so God said to Noah, I have decided to destroy all the living creatures, for they filled the earth with violence. Yes, I will wipe them out along with the earth. He says, build a large boat from cypress wood and waterproof it with tar inside and out. Then construct decks and stalls throughout its interior. Look, I'm about to cover the earth with a flood that will destroy every living thing that breathes. Everything on earth will die. A difficult concept to wrestle with. I mean, for those of us who take the words of the Bible seriously, we don't just relegate or delegate these to the concept of a myth. We take it seriously. One of the reasons we take it seriously is because there are extraordinary reasons for believing in Jesus of Nazareth, for believing that he is who he claimed to be, God incarnate. I mean, you wouldn't believe the evidence for that. Shocking. And Jesus of Nazareth was the one who claimed that this actually happened. Read it for yourself. Matthew chapter 24, he makes it clear this was real. He stands right beside it as though this was a reality. What do we do with this? Well, there's some difficulty here. I don't want to lie about that, but I have found some reasons which I have found very satisfying that help support the plausibility of the flood. One of the first reasons is that as we survey anthropological, sociological research, we discover global reports of the flood. I mean, we're talking about from all the ends of the earth, virtually every culture references a global flood. And what was the cause of the flood? The cause in these myths is taken to be that God was being just with the earth. He was angry at human evil and he wiped out humanity. Here's Charles Martin. This is from his book, Flood Legends. He says this, it is found, this legend, this maybe, if you will, a memory of a flood is found on every continent except for Antarctica, of course, many different countries and across a variety of people groups. Part of the appeal of the flood account is its widespread popularity among ancient cultures. In the fish myth of the Mahabharata, Manu is instructed to take 7 very specific people on board. That's not the only account that says that there were 8 people on board, exactly as Genesis 6 teaches. Noah, his wife, and his sons and their wives. 8 people. In the Karina myth, the survivors are told to contact or to stock the great canoe with 2 of every animal and a seed from every kind of plant. The Haraskin tribe of North America, so here we're on the other side of the world, tells of an old man who builds a raft and collects the drowning animals 2 by 2 as he floods past them. In fact, as we start to piece this together, we see that we have global accounts of the flood in Mexico, Hawaii. Okay, not too many Jewish people there when these legends were formed, right? That's totally the other side of the world. China, India. In fact, all in all, we have 270 worldwide accounts. And so how do we explain that? Could it be, and I'm not saying all these accounts are veridical, that they refer to, you know, precisely to the events of the flood. I am saying that collaboratively speaking, cumulatively speaking, this points to a common historical event. One of the stumbling blocks for the flood is the thought that we could have every single species on board this ark. And that just seems to stretch the credulity of thinking people to its absolute breaking point. How could we believe that? I mean, there's millions of species. Some taxonomists would put it at about 500 million different species. Well, here's my question. What makes you think that the Bible teaches that every species was on the ark? The concept of a species didn't originate 3,500 years ago when this was written. This originated back in the late 1700s with Linnaeus. He's the father of modern taxonomy. The whole concept of a phyla, a genus of species, comes from him. Okay, so we don't need to believe when it says 2 of every kind. It means 2 of every species. It just means 2 of every kind. What is a kind? I don't have a clue. I don't know, and neither do you. So we can just comfort each other in our ignorance. Species. This must mean like the basic category, something like that. The size of the ark. I know in Sunday school, maybe some of you grew up going to Sunday school where they have this little boat and the giraffe is poking its head out, and it basically looks like either like a small tank or like a large Hummer, something like that, you know. if we can take the biblical account seriously, the size of the ark was absolutely gargantuan. This was a huge barge, massive. Gleason Archer, who is a scholar of ancient Semitics and classics, he says in his survey of the Old Testament, given the dimensions of the ark, its capacity would then have been 3.6 million cubic feet. Is that right? Yeah, it says 300 cubits by 50 cubits by 30 cubits. What's a cubit? A cubit is the distance from the elbow to the fingers, about 18 inches, maybe 24 if you're Shaquille O'Neal. He says, if we do all the math here, we're looking at a huge rectangular box, 3.6 million cubic feet, or to put that in perspective, room enough for 2,000 cattle cars, each of which carries 18 to 20 cattle, or 60 to 80 hogs, or 80 to 100 sheep. He points out most types of animals are smaller than sheep. Sheep, humans, orangutans, elephants were kind of the big ones here. Only about 290 types of animals are bigger than sheep. Most animals are way smaller. And so as you start to look at the size, I mean, that could fit the Columbus Zoo in there with room for food, with three decks. I'm not going to say it's plenty of space, but it is a very voluminous, spread out room to pack on a lot of animals. One of the other difficulties with the plausibility of the flood is in the question of how there could be enough water to flood the earth. Even if we melt the polar ice caps, even if it was a different geology back then, it just strains your believability to be able to see that this could happen. Except that the Bible explicitly teaches in Genesis 7, verse 11, that the water did not just come down, but that the water actually came up through these torrents. All the underground waters erupted from the earth. You see, that's in contrast to the waters which come down from the sky. Interestingly enough, in between these fault zones in the mantle of the earth, we have discovered, I mean, really in the last couple decades, because we're talking way down deep, that there is an extraordinary amount of water underneath the earth's mantle to the order of 3.5 times the amount on the surface. So we're talking about a large amount of water. Now there's some difficulties with this. If that water was used, it would come out as steam. Okay, it's closer to the core than it is to the top. So there's problems with it. But just the concept of the volume of water, there were materials there. One of the final questions which confronts us here as people who are really wrestling with this text is the question of whether it is global or whether it's local. Is the text telling us that the entire globe, the entire planet Earth, was covered with water? Or is it possible to understand that it was just a local event? Well, I'd like to be able just to point to one or the other. The problem is I respect so many people on both sides. There's sharp thinking people, Norman Geisler, Francis Schaeffer, guys who have forgotten more about theology than I've ever learned. They're on the left side. And then there's guys on the right side who believe this was just a local event. Now, this isn't like the good guys versus the bad guys here. These are the Bible believers versus the Bible believers. They both believe that the Bible is true, that what it teaches is true. One point of agreement here between the two different camps or cadres of scholarship on this is that all of these different men, all these different scholars agree that whatever happened with the flood, it was universal judgment for humanity. They base this off of Jesus' comment, Matthew 24, verse 37, that just as the coming of the Son of Man, which will be a universal judgment, was the same way in the time of Noah. So what this would mean is that if you're a local theorist, that this was just a local flood, that would mean that if the water or humans, that's what I meant to say, if the humans made it up into Antarctica, then the flood would have stretched there. If they hadn't, the penguins would still be alive. Okay? If they made it south, if they made it west. So really, depending on how widespread the human race was how big the flood was. Well, there's some debate here, okay? Okay, let's look at this. On the one hand, the global theorists will say this, Genesis 6, 7. God says, I'm about to bring the flood of water upon the earth. The earth, the globe to destroy all flesh from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. How on earth do you get around that? Well, Genesis 41:57, according to the local guys, will say that the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph. What that can't be saying is that Joseph was giving out grain to like a Native American dude, right? He's showing up like, hey, where's the grain? Like, well, you came a far way, take double, you know. This must be hyperbolic language, right? It's referring to something really big. Maybe it's actually not that big, universal, as we might think. The whole earth, in Hebrew, the term earth, dirt, land, globe, they all have the same word. The ancient Hebrews had a vocabulary of 3,000 words. I mean, it was like Tarzan, man. Very simple. And so each of their words had a huge semantic range. Even the expression, the whole earth, is used for the local geography of Israel. But wait just one minute. It says from everywhere under heaven. Nice try. You answer the whole earth, but what about everything under heaven? There's a problem there too. Deuteronomy 2 says, this day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the peoples everywhere under the heavens. It's not that people, you know, the Aztecs were hearing about the Jewish people. The people of everywhere under the heavens would presumably refer to the ancient Near East. Just like when it says that the gospel has been preached to everywhere under heaven, it's not referring to every people group. It's hyperbole. Okay, the local people will come back. Okay, they're going to pull out their six-shooter and fire this. It says that the water was dried up from the earth. The earth was dry. Now, wait a minute. After the flood, what would that mean? Are you saying that the entire globe, the entire planet Earth went dry? No oceans, no lakes, no rivers? Well, the global people would come back and say, come on, give me a break. This refers to the floodwaters. That's the context that is being referred to here. The global people come back and fire away and say, well, why was it necessary to pack up all the animals? If this was just a local flood, why is there all of this care for the animals in the area? The local people are like, okay, first of all, you're heartless. God cared about those animals. And secondly, Noah could have used that to jumpstart his herds. If this was a local flood, this would have been huge, okay? And so it would have been hard to get out there to get personal herds back. Possible, possible. Genesis 7:19, it says, all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. Mount Everest, covered. Okay, that's talking about a huge amount of water. The difficulty is the local person will come back and say covered. That Hebrew word kashah means residing upon, running over, falling upon. Kind of like when we say we got 6 inches of rain. We don't mean that there's a standing 6 inches. We mean that we got that much volume that came down. A huge flash flood, like read about this, Genesis 7:20. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 20 feet. Or, is it as John Walton translates here, 20 feet, 15 cubits from above. Milmala rose the waters and the mountains were covered. This would be the view that it was covered in the sense that 15 feet of water came down, not necessarily that it was submerged. That's another way of taking the Hebrew language there. 15 feet of water would be a flash flood that could kill anything. That's for sure. Genesis 8:4, the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat. So it got a 450-foot barge. And you're saying that there was enough water to lift it up onto the top of Mount Ararat. Do you know how tall that is? 17,000 feet. Okay, if there's enough water to put it on top of the mountain of Ararat, that would be enough water to flood the whole earth. What do you say to that, you local scum? They say, note that it doesn't say the mountain of Ararat. It refers to the mountains, plural. Could be one of the smaller mountains. Some people even point out that the Hebrew word for mountains is the word gar, which could mean hill. Genesis 8:5, global comes back. The water decreased steadily. The tops of the mountains became visible. The mountains were being visible. Of course, this could be perspectival language. Like when my meteorologist tells me that the sun is rising at 7:05 this morning. Didn't he go to college? Doesn't he know that the sun doesn't go around the earth? It's perspectival. It's from our perspective. It's rising. That would fit with Genesis 8:5. The tops of the mountains became visible. About Genesis 8:11, the dove came to him and in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. Local people would say, how could there be a tree out there? There's been a flood of water. How could there be trees with olive leaves? Global would come back and say, if the flood wasn't global, why didn't God just command Noah to move his family to a safe location? It's a good point. Like, he gets done with like 100 years of building this huge ark, and he's just like, ah. Oh. And then he's like, how bad's the flood? And he's like, oh, it's just from here to Cincinnati. It's just like, oh, my God. When I get off this ark, I'm going to get so drunk. I'm so angry, I could just strip naked and run around. Local, maybe people would have followed him. Maybe if he went up there, the people would have followed. Maybe there was no safe place. I mean, even a local flood would be a huge flood. Maybe there was just no place. I don't know. Global has scientific difficulties. For one, if there was salt water that just covered the entire earth, how do we have freshwater lakes? This would all be mixed in. How do we have freshwater fish? Those would be wiped out. Kangaroos, which are located in the island of Australia. We don't have any fossils of them hopping up to the ancient Near East. We don't have any fossils of them coming back. They don't leave any ancestors. We just have them there in Australia. There's ancient volcanoes that have these ash scoria, basically delicate ash mounds that we can show have not been disturbed for 50,000 years. Penguins, how on earth did they make it from the poles to the middle of a desert? How did they survive? What did the polar bears eat when they got off the ark? What did they eat? If not from a population of other things from which you could have predation. There's difficulty, and yet the global flood person would come back and say, God is a God of the miraculous. And I think that's a salient point. I don't think we should just dismiss that and say, well, that's really ad hoc. It is an ad hoc. To teach God calculus is no more different than teaching him 2 + 2. Okay? He knows all things, right? We think that was silly to say that God would have to learn something. Well, the concept here is he's not too weak. None of this would make him break a sweat. He could do this if he wanted to. Here's a problem for the local. They say, oh, there's not enough water to flood the earth. Well, hold on a second. Even to float an ark of that size, 3.6 billion cubic feet, you would need 6 billion acre feet of water, according to Hugh Ross, and he's a local theorist. So there's problems here. There's problems. Which view is correct? Let me know if you find out. Email me, because I'd love to find out. I'm not sure. I think in these kind of situations, when we don't know, we should just look at both sides, go back and forth, and say, we don't know. We weren't there. Both of them make good points. Here's Francis Schaeffer. He says, Christians who love the scripture have discussed at length whether the flood was global or not. He says, I believe that it was, but I do not think by any means that we should make it a test of orthodoxy. So we should never say, well, you believe in a local flood, and so you're a heretic or something like that. This is one of those areas where there's room for disagreement. One final point, though. If God truly does exist, flooding the earth would be no more difficult than flooding a bathtub. And I'm not speaking with an exaggerated tone. I mean literally no different. The God of the Bible is powerful. If he wants to do something, he doesn't exert effort. He just speaks and it happens. We've already seen that there's incredible evidence for creation. In that case, he didn't bring water from a different location. He brought matter and energy from nothing. Okay, so to bring things from nothing, an ex nihilo creation into something, well, this has never really troubled me that much. Well, we might as well finish up our account here. So Noah did everything exactly as God commanded him. When everything was ready, the Lord said to Noah, go into the boat with all your family. For among all the people of the earth, I can see that you alone are righteous. So Noah did everything as the Lord commanded him. A male and female of each kind entered just as God had commanded Noah. And then the Lord closed the door. an interesting verse. You're building a 50, 75 foot tall barge. Think of what the door would look like. Some kind of a massive plank. There was no instructions for Noah on how to get that door up. Apparently he came onto the ark. There was animals in there. And he's probably sitting in there as the water started to rise, just thinking, how are we going to get this door closed? And probably out of an act of mercy for Noah, God was the one who closed it. You know, in other words to say, this isn't your decision. There is going to come a time when judgment is going to come. And God was extremely patient. In fact, we read in 2 Peter 2:5, Noah was there warning the world of God's righteous judgment. So God protected Noah when he destroyed the world of ungodly people with a vast flood. He was protecting him, but Noah was also out there speaking to people. And I bet people there, I bet it was pretty embarrassing for Noah, wouldn't you say? To be sitting there building a 450-foot barge in the middle of a desert. Most of these people had never seen the ocean, never seen a big lake. They'd seen rivers. I bet they were coming up there with their lunches, looking at Noah building his ark, just saying, what are you doing? And Noah's like, there's going to be judgment. There's going to be a flood. But these people are just scoffing at him. And none of them decided to come on the ark with him. Not a single person. Really, what we're seeing here is kind of a prefiguring, foreshadowing, where God was judging humanity back in the time of Noah. And the Bible teaches he's going to come back and do that again. Jesus says in Matthew 24, verse 37, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up until the day Noah entered the ark. These people were just doing their thing. They were living their lives. Noah was out there telling them, you got to have a change of heart. You got to get on board. They didn't listen. They rejected God's offer. They knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Well, what we're seeing here is a connection in the story. This is why it's applicable for today. Jesus will return. You know, there's a lot of things that Noah believed that his culture thought was pretty stupid. He's building a huge ark. He's pouring time, talent, and treasure into this huge building project to be in God's plan. And I bet the people of his day were saying, why don't you take it easy? Why are you so obsessed with God? It's like you're a radical. It's like you're a fanatic. What are you doing? You know, it's interesting that people in our day will often say the same thing about people who are really dedicated to the cause of Christ. They look at them and they say, you know, frankly, why are you wasting your time? What's the big deal? Why do you think this is so important? You know, you could really be somebody. You're so gifted. You're so talented. You could be using that for a purpose. And you know, from our perspective, we're in the same shoes as Noah. We realize that Christ is coming back. You know, our culture doesn't believe that either. But he is. And you know, I bet Noah felt really stupid right until that door closed. You might be thinking to yourself, yeah, I've heard about this message of receiving Christ, the message of forgiveness. I'll do that at some point. You don't know when that door is going to close. That could happen at any moment. Jesus says that I will return just like a thief in the night. The thing about thieves is they don't call ahead. Okay? They just show up. Jesus says nobody knows the day or the hour. You don't know when you die and go and face God or when God is going to come back and face you. But he is coming back. And so there is a limited time period here. By way of conclusion, let's ask the question, you know, was Noah rescued because he was such a righteous, perfect man? Well, as we've already seen, the answer is no. The only righteousness that he had was the fact that he was in fellowship with God. It says that he walked closely with God. The same thing is true of believers today. Believers in Christ are now more righteous than anybody else. Anybody who's self-righteous really doesn't understand Christianity. Because as Christians, we realize that we don't get our righteousness from ourselves. We get it from God. We get it as a gift, something that was given to us. The second question which confronts us here is God going to judge? You know, I know a lot of people laugh about this. If I judge and I go to get judged and go to hell, I'll be down there partying with my friends, man. We're going to be rocking on with AC/DC, Highway to Hell, you know. That's what I used to say, you know. Rather be having fun in hell than having a, you know, boring time in heaven. Well, guess what? Hell is not a joke. There's nothing funny about it. And God doesn't want you to go there. It's a place of judgment. Yes, he is going to judge. No, he's not going to passively stand by and just accept evil and suffering in this world. He will judge. Yes, he will. That's the bad news. But the good news is that just like Noah had an ark, we have an ark too. And Peter writes about this, one of Jesus' disciples. He was reading this text in Genesis 6, and he sees a connection that just as Noah was put into this ark, and he was protected from God's judgment. He says, so too, as believers, we are rescued through an ark. He says in 1 Peter 3, God patiently waited in the days of Noah as an ark was being constructed. That's true, isn't it? God's patience. How could he look at human evil for thousands of years, being nauseated, being angry, being sick? How could he hold back his judgment? The question isn't, does God judge? The question is, why hasn't he done it yet? Well, he says God was being patient while this ark was being built. In the ark, a few, 8 people, were delivered through the water. And this prefigured, foreshadowed baptism. Now, some people will say, baptism, yeah, I was dunked in some water when I was a baby or when I was a kid. Yeah, I've been baptized, so I'm good. No, you're not. That's not what he's referring to here. If we're thinking of water baptism, the people who were water baptized in Genesis 6 were the people who weren't in the ark. Baptism here are the people who were put into the ark. Baptism here is what's called spiritual baptism. The ark is Christ being put into him, the protection of that huge ark. Peter says we've got a better ark. We're put into the person of Christ. We're protected by him. So when God comes down to judge, he doesn't see me. He sees the innocence and the perfection of Christ. In fact, I can prove that. You want me to prove it? The very next line. Not the washing off of physical dirt. Not water baptism. He says this is an issue of the heart, but the pledge of a good conscience to God through the resurrection of Christ. To change your heart, to turn to God and to say, yes, I need you. God, I want you in my life. I want you to pay for my sins. No, I don't want to stand up in front of you when I die and have to answer for every sin I've ever committed. I want you to have Jesus pay for that for me. I want that personally done for me. The Bible says at that moment, you can get into that ark and it's not too late. You could do that here with us tonight. You can make that decision to have that change of heart where you come to meet Christ personally.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.